dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. Our guest today is James Hassan. He is the author of a tremendously important and frankly much needed new book entitled Stand Down, How Social Justice Warriors Are Sabotaging America's Military. It is informed by his own experience in the military. He rose through the ranks of the United States Army to captain. He was a graduate of the Ranger School in the Army and also served in Afghanistan. He is taking on one of the most important topics of our time, and we couldn't be more pleased to have a chance for a full hour to talk with him about his book, Stand Down, and its important insights. James Hassan, welcome to Secure Freedom Radio.
Thank you very much, Frank, for having me.
Let me do some level setting here before we get into some of the particulars of your analysis. You ask in the book, what is the military for? Which seems like one of those no-brainer questions, and yet, for reasons we're going to be discussing, it has been anything but, particularly under the influence of the social justice warriors.
That's right, yeah. So that's the threshold question that everything that I speak about in the book and all of these issues really should be evaluated through. And the military is and should be a unique institution in our society that has a singular mission, and that is to defend us all by preparing to fight and win the nation's wars. But there are some on the left that clearly viewed it differently, and that was the Obama administration and a lot of the ideologues that they appointed absolutely saw it more as a blunt force tool for driving broader social change. But at the end of the day, the military is for fighting wars.
Yeah, fighting and, needless to say, winning wars. I would argue that it's also for deterring wars because you'd really rather not fight them. Nobody understands that better than military men like yourself. But there's a quote that we're going to come to in a moment about this by Valerie Jarrett, who was one of the most malign forces, I believe, in the Obama administration. Advisor, close advisor, in fact, very close confidant of President Obama, long before he came to office and then throughout his presidency. But before we get to that, let's define another key term here. In your subtitle of your book, which I think is extraordinarily apt, you have how social justice warriors are sabotaging America's military. We hear a lot about social justice. Give us just your working definition of what that agenda entails and who are the warriors that are advancing it.
Yes, I would say that the way I use the term, at least, are progressive ideologues and those focused primarily on identity politics versus any other metric for success within society or the military in general.
And by identity politics, you mean that you're a male, you're a female, or you're some other gender, you're gay, or you're something, some other subset. Okay.
Exactly. And a lot of what you would see coming out of, college campuses, which we rightly mock, but when you're dealing with that kind of mindset in a military context, then the consequences can be deadly. But so a lot of the folks that I speak about in my book are the political appointees from the Obama administration. And obviously there's plenty of pressure from outside groups too, but unlike previous administrations and unlike this administration, the Obama administration appointed just fewer political animals in many cases to run the you know, things like the Secretary of the Navy or the Undersecretary of Defense, basically to run the Pentagon in all of the influential positions. And because the military is by design and by necessity an authoritarian institution, they drove change from the top down and imposed it on the military.
It had that unique attribute, didn't it? That if you wanted to transform America through the transformation of its military, you could do it basically by fiat through these political appointees at the Pentagon, as well as, of course, the White House. Which brings us to President Obama's agenda, and he made no bones about it. 5 days, I would believe it was, before the first election in 2008, he said, we are within days of, quote, fundamentally transforming America, unquote. It looked at through the prism of what was being done during his presidency to the Pentagon, and to some extent continues to afflict it to this day. How would you characterize the Obama administration's agenda, especially with respect to this social justice, phenomenon?
Well, you're absolutely right that they absolutely did accomplish a fundamental transformation of the military. So for that subsegment of society, Obama absolutely kept his promise. But their goal was one, to impose the left's view of equality, which is a lot of the times equality of results versus equality of opportunity, or basically this left-wing focus on, like we said, identity politics, on immutable traits versus simply merit. And if you take all of the goals of kind of the progressive left, the Obama administration looked at the military as, well, this is a controlled institution. And at the end of the day, what they say goes. And the men and women in uniform have little say in this publicly, because they can't speak publicly. And they have, generally speaking, not a whole lot of money to give a lot of, campaign contributions. They have precious little lobbying power. And so that's why public discussion of these issues is critical.
Yeah, it is. And it's why your new book, Stand Down, How Social Justice Warriors Are Sabotaging America's Military, is so critical, James Hassan, for the purpose of informing that needed public debate. And we're going to do a fair amount more of it in the three segments ahead. More with James Hassan about this social justice warrior campaign against our military and against us, right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. This is perhaps one of, if not the most important program we've done in 10 years of this broadcast, Secure Freedom Radio. And that's because we're talking about an issue that has rarely been talked about. Again, I want to give a shout out to my friend Elaine Donnelly of the Center for Military Readiness. We've talked with her often over the years, and she has done incalculably important work. But in this instance, we're visiting with James Hassan. He is a veteran of the United States Army. He served in Afghanistan, a graduate of the Army's Ranger School, and the author of an extraordinarily needed book. It's entitled Stand Down: How Social Justice Warriors Are Sabotaging America's Military. James, thank you for this book. James, let me start this segment off by putting out a long-held thesis of my own, with which you may agree or disagree. And that is that what Barack Obama was about with respect to the military was, as I've often said, not simply using it as an instrument for social justice or fundamental transformation of America. I think that was clearly part of it. As we discussed earlier, it was something that could be done quite efficiently by virtue of the discipline and, well, you call it authoritarian, but the highly controlled institution that the military is. But it seemed to me, watching it closely, running, you know, careful analyses of this project on air as well as elsewhere at the Center for Security Policy, that what Barack Obama's administration was really about was a wrecking operation against the United States military. It I think, as is true of the hard left, resents the armed forces. Convinced that they are guilty of war crimes. It doesn't like the expenditure on its weapon systems. It saw it as essentially an institution that, you know, repudiated or at least did not adhere to their social justice priorities. So for all these reasons, I felt as though it was more than just a blunt instrument, as we've said, to, you know, affect broader social change. But I did want to invite you to comment on that, but also to just describe for us what we know for sure, beyond dispute, from the mouth of this advisor to the president, Valerie Jarrett. Remind us of her comment, if you would.
Sure. I wouldn't agree entirely with all of that. I think that rather than, you know, attributing a lot of this to intentionally nefarious activities, I would say, you know, and the thesis of my book, or that, you know, a theme that runs through it, is that I think that it stems from a fundamental disagreement about what the purpose is, or just a simple fundamental misunderstanding of the military. So General John Kelly, for instance, when a lot of these changes were coming down, said that every policy in the military should just be viewed simply through the lens of whether or not this helps us fight wars. If the answer is yes, we should do it. If the answer is no, then we shouldn't. And if the answer is I don't know, then the answer should still be no, because we don't know if it's going to hurt our ability. And that's a standard that General Mattis endorsed, to use his terms, vociferously. And that's I think that's the fundamental misunderstanding or disagreement between some of the activists who are pushing these changes and the men and women who are serving in uniform. So, for example, you mentioned that Valerie Jarrett quote, and I think it's a perfect example. And I lead off chapter one of my book with that quote, because she's giving a speech at a gala to military members and during Obama's second term. And she said, "You have the power to lead change, not just in society or not just in the military, but within society as a whole. And so we're going to be pursuing a lot of bold agendas or bold initiatives in, for the rest of our term," which I think is just emblematic of that approach to the military, which was that it was this tool for pushing social change versus simply an institution that should be focused solely on making sure that it's, ready to prepare to fight and win the nation's wars, and by doing so, also deter the nations, you know, deter war.
Let me just say, we can have an honorable disagreement about this. I think if you look at the sort of broader agenda and conduct of this administration, it may be that there's sufficient evidence to support my thesis. Not just yours, but let's stick with yours for the moment, because there's plenty to indict on that basis. And I want to start, if I can, by going through some of the examples of how this agenda of fundamentally transforming the military in the service of fundamentally transforming the country manifested itself. And let's start with personnel. You spoke at the beginning, James Hesson, about the degree to which political appointees were engaged for the purpose of effecting this transformation. Give us some examples of the kind of people who were entrusted with senior positions in the Defense Department, both civilian and military, for that matter.
Sure. So a lot of the examples that I pull from were Obama's political appointees. And so I think one very easy example would be a gentleman named Ray Mabus, who was Secretary of the Navy for all 8 years, and who had an environmentalist record before he came to Obama DOD, but who, you know, from speaking to admirals who interacted with him, from naval officials who interacted with him, was simply a guy who was obsessed with social justice and not with making sure that the military was, or the Navy, which was under his control, was a finely honed force. And I asked one of those admirals I spoke to whether or not, you know, Mabus was receptive to their professional judgment. And this gentleman just laughed and he said, no, he had no use for us unless we just said, yes, sir, three bags full. But then another example would be former acting Undersecretary of Defense Brad Carson, who in an interview with NPR said that, a lot of the changes were part of their ambition to, quote, make the Department of Defense the nation's most progressive employer, which, is not the job of the Department of Defense. It's not supposed to be as woke as Apple or Google or anything else for that matter.
Well, or woke at all, really, is the point. As you say, and I think the Kelly mantra is just right, it should be about preparedness to fight and win the nation's war. Full stop. To think of it as an employment agency, progressive or otherwise, is really beside the point, and perhaps quite contrary to the actual purpose of the military. I just have to note that one of the hallmarks of Ray Mabus's tenure, of course, was some of the people that he saw fit to elevate to the very exalted position of having American combat vessels named after them. And give us a couple of examples of Ray Mabus's choice.
USS Cesar Chavez, the labor activist. I think that's kind of a perfect example. Yeah, how far have we gotten from,
And Harvey Milk, for heaven's sakes, yay, supervisor out in California, San Francisco, who was tragically murdered, but this was a rather extraordinary choice, when by and large, those vessels have been named for military heroes or, of course, cities in our country, battle spaces, and so on. But this is again, a sort of almost laughable example of the degree to which this so-called progressive agenda was foisted on the military. Let's talk about some of the not-so-funny agenda items for these social justice warriors and their implications for the fighting trim of our military. And by that, I mean, as you know so well, James Hesson, as a man who served in uniform, not just, readiness in the sense of how prepared our ships or our tanks or our aircraft or personnel are to fight the nation's wars, but also their morale. This is an incredibly important ingredient, it seems to me, that's often overlooked, particularly by those of us who haven't served as you have in uniform. But could we start with the idea, the idée fixe, you might say, of women in combat? We only have about a minute, but just walk us through very briefly. Introduce the topic. We'll talk more about it on the other side.
So just to briefly introduce the topic, even the phrase women in combat was kind of an Orwellian triumph of the left, as phrasing of the issue, because the issue was never about whether women were constitutionally capable of being in combat. In fact, female Apache pilots, for example, flew missions with 30 millimeter guns, you know, attached or synced to their helmets, their pilots' helmets, and, you know, killing terrorists. So the issue was never that. The issue was simply, should we have gender neutral infantry units for that, you know, 3% of the Army or the Marines that have to put up to 100 pounds of equipment on their back and walk for 12 to 15 miles at a time.
Hold that thought, James Hassan. We have to come back to what else flowed from this decision. We'll do that with more, with the author of a splendid and really required reading new book on a subject vital to our national security. It's entitled Stand Down, How Social Justice Warriors Are Sabotaging America's Military. James Hassan will be right back with us right after this.
More with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back, and it's my delight to say that we have been blessed with a full hour of James Hassan's time to explore some of his own personal experiences inside the United States Army and the military more generally, and the kinds of takeaways from such service that have informed his splendid new book, Stand Down, How Social Justice Warriors Are Sabotaging America's Military. And James, with altogether too little time to introduce the topic, I threw at you the question of women in combat, and you were beginning to walk us through some of the practical implications of asking women to perform in ground combat units specifically. And I want you to talk about both the challenges that are entailed in doing the job, but also the implications for pretending that they can do it without any particular difficulty.
Yeah, as I mentioned, you know, this phrase was, you know, it was framed as women in combat, but it should have been women, you know, whether or not to create gender neutral infantry. And when the Obama administration was pushing that change, a lot of military leaders were very resistant to that idea. So one of the things that happened is the Marines said, hey, give us a year. Let us study this. And if the data says we should do it, we'll do it. And if the data says that we shouldn't, then we shouldn't. And so what they did is they went out to 29 Palms, California, and they conducted a year-long study where they measured the performance of all male infantry squads versus gender-neutral infantry squads.
And by gender-neutral, you mean they had both male and female soldiers on the ground?
And so what they found is that and they measured a whole host of, you know, over 100 different metrics, and everybody wore heart monitors. And they even had outside data experts to crunch the data to make sure that, you know, their findings were free of any kind of institutional bias. There was a group that the Marines called the Nerd Squad, if I remember correctly. And so what they found was that the all-male units that the traditional infantry model that the Marines had outperformed the mixed sex in units by a metric of close to 70%. And one of the stats that they referenced was that it would take, I think, up to 160% longer to evacuate a casualty from an incapacitated Marine from a vehicle. And if that vehicle is on fire, then the difference between life and death can be seconds. And so when seconds matter, then extra minutes can be deadly. But so they presented, you know, they completed that year-long study, and they wrote up a report, and Ray Mabus, who was in charge of the Navy at the time, simply refused to even read it in its entirety. And you know, talk about not wanting to know.
Talk about gross dereliction of duty.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, one of the memos that the Marine generals you know, involved in that study prepared is a quote from in my book. And there's a quote from this brigadier general who said, our enemies will be the ultimate arbiters of this decision. And, you know, whether if we pay, and I'm paraphrasing now, but basically if we ignore immutable realities, such as physical differences between male and female Marines, then at the end of the day, this, you know, our enemies will be the arbiters of this when the lives of our male and female Marines are hanging in the balance.
Well, and that's at the micro level. At the macro level, it may be the difference between victory and defeat. And that is unconscionable. I mean, it's bad enough if it's just the needless loss of our servicemen and women's lives. It's that we may compromise the mission. Hey, let me ask you, James, one of the things that we talk about frequently with our guest, Elaine Donnelly, is the other somewhat more intangible but very real impact on readiness that, as I mentioned earlier, arises from damaging morale. And she has documented over the years, it's been controversial and, needless to say, been deeply unwelcomed by the social justice warriors, evidence that when you have mixed units, one of the other phenomena, in addition to diminished readiness or war fighting, is all kinds of problems that inevitably arise from male and female personnel operating in very close quarters, whether that's emotional issues or family challenges or pregnancies. I mean, can you just give us a sense of what those knock-on effects are and how they impact morale and readiness as well?
Yeah, well, what I would say is that at the outset, for the Marines who were conducting a study, to have it totally ignored was a huge, essentially a slap in the face, because they did everything right, and it was entirely rejected.
Rejected without even having been fully taken aboard, which is doubly scandalous.
You know, whenever you have political figures who don't even see the mission the same way that you do, or either fundamentally misunderstand it, then that's a huge morale killer all on its own. And I think in terms of the morale impacts kind of at the individual level, some of that hasn't been even fully measured. But what I can say is that General Mattis, who is, when he came into the position of Secretary of Defense, gave a speech at VMI.
That's the Virginia Military Institute.
Mm-hmm. The Virginia Military Institute, exactly. And that was something that he brought up. He said, this is basically, you're talking about a very specific culture, and the changes to that, are intangible, but they're very, very meaningful. So I think, Mattis's point was, we have to look at what those changes to culture mean as well, because we're talking about the tip of the spear units that we all rely upon.
Right. Could I this isn't meant to be a quibble. I think it's an important point to emphasize. To the extent that we're talking about having a different assessment of the mission or prioritizing certain aspects of the mission over those that have traditionally been defining missions, namely fighting and prevailing in combat, especially ground combat, arguably the hardest combat there is. It seems as though the indifference of these political appointees translated into really a disdain for, or at least a disregard for, those critical functions, as you say, the pointy end of the spear. And that's part of what worries me about all of this, and the lingering effect of it, James Sasson, is especially concerning after the Mabuses and company cleared out, and now even the Mattises and some of his people have cleared out. To what extent do military units continue to suffer from some of the decisions that were taken during the Obama years and the derogation of those vital military missions to the social experimentation or engineering, as you call it, that is now part and parcel of the military's, standard operating procedure?
Yeah, I think the harms come in two forms. So you have policy harms, such as, the Obama administration had a rule that allowed service members to serve according to the physical readiness standards of the gender that they identified with rather than those designed for their biological sex. And so things like that, where the Obama or the Trump administration, have wound that back and required people to serve according to biological sex, those policy changes can be rolled back with a stroke of a pen. And so that's one policy change that's been corrected.
Took a long time to do it, though, I have to say, and a lot of to-ing and fro-ing.
Yeah, well, and the infantry policy that we spoke about hasn't, that's still in effect, and we talked about the harms that that'll cause. But then there are also cultural changes, and those are harder to roll back, because the longer that they stay in force, the more ingrained that they become, and the more difficult they become to reverse. And so, for example, I think if you're talking about even just one small emblematic anecdote of those cultural changes, one of the things that I list in the book is that most Americans, I think, would be appalled to learn that at the U.S. Naval Academy, there are safe space placards outside some instructors' doors that literally say, "I am a safe space." But then among other things, and that's both uniformed and civilian, and then among other things say that the instructors have taken a sensitivity course called Trans 101, put on by contractors from Google. there are no safe spaces in Afghanistan or really anywhere else for that. But when you start to look at those, those types of changes, the longer they stay in force, the more detrimental they are. And that's just one small example of many that are just littered throughout the book.
That is so important to emphasize, because again, if we're going to see this social justice agenda unwound in terms of what it has been doing to the United States military, we're going to have to start from the premise that all of its manifestations need to be rooted out. And in particular, I think I'm sure you yourself at some point along your distinguished career, James Hassan, were subjected to sensitivity training and obliged to ensure that you measured up on that count, perhaps even more than in terms of your performance as a ranger in combat, which is absurd. And yet there seems to be evidence that it is indeed being given, even today, the priority treatment or consideration in the promotion of officers or enlisted personnel. So, we have to pause for just one more break. We will be right back with our final installment with James Hassan, talking about vital matters with respect to the national security of the United States in his new book, Stand Down, How Social Justice Warriors Are Sabotaging America's Military. We'll be right back.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We're visiting with James Hassan, the author of Stand Down, How Social Justice Warriors Are Sabotaging America's Military. He has great insights into this topic from his own service in the United States military. He graduated from the Army Ranger School and served in infantry in Afghanistan. Insights, as I say, but also some very practical ideas about what needs to be done now about all of this social engineering in the military, and we'll come to that in a moment. But before we do, I did want to just ask you a bit more, James, about the training that's taking place, whether it's sensitivity training or whether it's what is being given to our, next generations of officers through the various military academies. Give us a flavor of what's afoot there, even now.
Yeah, so I'm not an academy grad myself. I went to the University of Notre Dame, go Irish. But I spoke with scores of sources for my book, ranging from two, three-star admirals who are in the room while these discussions were being debated, to infantry officers and kind of soldiers and Marines and airmen at all levels. And one of the things that I try and do in the book is capture the insights that the academy grads had and channel those, to kind of allow them to speak through me. And a lot of them expressed significant concerns about what was happening at the academies. And because those are the institutions that shape our future leaders of soldiers and Marines. And as one decorated Army infantry officer told me, it said, if you want to know what the Army is going to look like in 5 to 10 years, go to West Point and see what they're teaching, see what the culture is and see what the changes are being made, because that's what the Army is going to look like. And so the one example before the break that we talked about were with those safe space placards at the Naval Academy, but that's, I'd be remiss if I didn't also point out changes at other institutions. So at the Air Force Academy, for example, one of the examples that I pointed out in the book was that after a non-commissioned officer addressed uniform standards in an academy-wide email and referenced simply discussing off-duty grooming appearance, and he referenced Michael Jordan in the email saying that, Michael Jordan was always professional, even off the court, and had a suit and tie and didn't have his pants around his ankles, I think is the example that he used. But apparently somebody found that offensive, and then the academy leadership sent an academy-wide email apologizing for the, quote, microaggression committed by the non-commissioned officers simply doing his job, which has always been the job of a non-commissioned officer, which is to uphold standards.
And I guess that's what's so troubling more generally, isn't it, James, is that there's a lot of erosion of standards here, and it makes me so concerned. But I think also, just to this point, in terms of thinking about what the future military is going to look like, it's not enough just to look at the military academies. You need to look at the society itself, from which, of course, in an all-volunteer force, majority of those who will be in uniform are drawn. Just give us a sense of what the implications of sort of the social warfare agenda on the society at large might portend for the military as well.
Right. I think you're absolutely right that you have an all-volunteer force, and even to the extent that we didn't, the military is reflective of the society that it's drawn from. And so when you have these millennial or Gen Z generations that, over 75% right now are ineligible, I think that's the number, for even serving in the military due to whether it's obesity or criminal records or lack of a high school education.
Or physical fitness more generally, yeah.
Yes, exactly. But then when you ask, well, how do you draw recruits from generations that now express patriotism at far lower levels than the greatest generation or even the generations before or between the greatest generation and Gen Z? And that's a problem on its own. But then also, if you have kids coming up in high school and colleges being taught about microaggressions or the need for a safe space or basically this kind of cultural influence we have now, where being a victim is kind of an exalted, people look for victimhood.
Yeah. To say nothing of hostility towards the country itself, which is a whole nother kettle of fish.
Right. I mean, if you look at the percentage of people who say they're proud to be an American, it's lower in those generations. So I think that's a background, factor. That's a background context under which these other changes are also taking place. And I think that in some ways is its own national security crisis.
It is. It is indeed. So let's turn quickly in the remaining time, James, to some of the recommendations that you've identified in Stand Down as to what needs to be done to remedy or undo, if possible, the cumulative effects of all of this social engineering by the so-called social justice warriors from the Obama years and those that may still be at large in the military today.
Yeah, that's the final chapter of the book. Chapter 9 is where I lay out a lot of things that I think need to be basically the way forward. And so one thing that the Trump administration, as I mentioned, did right was making sure that people have to serve according to their biological sex versus, whichever gender they identify, standards that apply to whichever gender they identify with. So that's one thing they've done well.
And is that now being faithfully implemented inside the military, as best you can tell?
Yeah, that as far as I can tell, absolutely. Although the Obama administration and Obama appointees, even such as Eric Fanning, who was Secretary of the Army, and then Ray Mabus, Secretary of the Navy, and also the former Secretary of the Air Force, have joined have supported a lawsuit to try and force the current Commander-in-Chief to implement the previous Commander-in-Chief's policies, which, as far as I can tell, is the first time in history that's ever happened. So that's one thing they've done well. But I know we're short on time, so I think what we need to do is follow the Marine Corps study on infantry units. And they showed conclusively with data that the all-male infantry units perform better and are more effective. And if our only goal is to have a clear-eyed national security policy that enables our military to fight and win wars, then we have to follow that. And then there are also some smaller but significant changes that could take place. And so one of the things that I mentioned is that the Pentagon needs its own version of the VA Accountability Act. So it recently, President Trump signed the VA Accountability Act, which made it easier to fire or remove bureaucrats who are not performing and weren't serving our veterans. Well, we need a similar model for the Pentagon, because as a three-star admiral I spoke with told me, he had a bureaucrat in the Pentagon just tell him no to his face when he told him to do something. And basically the guy's attitude, he said, was, well, I'm going to be here in 2 years and you won't. And so we have to make it easier to remove entrenched interests or ideologues or just individuals who simply aren't willing to do their job effectively.
Yeah. This has been called the swamp in certain contexts, and it certainly is operating inside the military's bureaucracy or civilian side at the Pentagon.
Plenty of Pentagon bureaucracy that should be cleaned out. And then I think the last thing that I would say is that at the academies, there's been a significant rise in the number of civilian professors who are instructing, cadets or midshipmen and whatnot. So in 1992, at West Point, it was about 2-3% of professors were non-military or civilian academics. And now that number is a quarter. And where that matters is, you look at the infamous example of the commie cadet, Spencer Rapone. He was mentored by his civilian history professor, who bragged to one of the uniformed instructors that, quote, Spencer's experimenting with Marxism. And I spoke with some former and current academy professors, and that was something that they put their finger on as a reason for changes to the academies, is that you shouldn't have civilian academics preparing cadets to lead soldiers in the future and then possibly lead them in war.
Yeah. Well, it seems to me that whether they're civilian instructors or they're military instructors, you don't want them to be focused on the social justice agenda. You want them preparing those young men and women to do their job as the front line of the defense of the free world. James Hassan, there is so much more to talk with you about. I hope that you will come back to us both with further thoughts drawn from your book, Stand Down, How Social Justice Warriors Are Sabotaging America's Military, and also your insights into the degree to which some of the recommendations you're making are heeded and affecting important changes. Thank you for your service to our country, both that in uniform and that you're rendering today. And I hope the rest of you will come back to us again on Monday. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.